Well, from the precious metal complex, everything else is hotter than gold. I'm talking purely from a price point of view. They've appreciated a lot more. I mean, for example, silver made an all-time high. It's purely from a price appreciation point of view, they have risen a lot more than gold. I was just, trying to make sure that although people have focused on gold, it's actually the slowest moving of the precious metal complex.
Welcome to Natural Resource Stocks. I'm Steve Yang, and today we're unpacking how markets really move. My guest is Alex Spiriglou with Smart Trader Systems. Alex is a macro trader, market technician, one of the sharpest minds on momentum, risk, market regime behavior. And Alex is known for developing frameworks that help traders understand where we are in the cycle, build robust systems, and learn to shift when it's appropriate. Alex, it's great to have you, to learn from you in a world of uncertainty. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much. First, thank you for the invitation, Steve. It's a really honor to be here. Just one slight correction, if you will. I'm not one of the sharpest minds by definition. And that's why I'm trying to have a rules-based approach. And that's the ultimate proof that I'm not sharp, because if I was, I wouldn't need the rules to guide my decision making. Because I'm not the sharpest mind, so that's why I have to have rules so I don't mess it up.
Well, you know what you need to get the job done, and we've got lots to learn from you. And so, thanks for being on our show, Alex. To start off, I'd love to look at market cycles. I mean, you spent years studying how markets move through different phases. And when you talk about market cycles, what do we mean here? I mean, is it business cycle, liquidity cycle, sentiment, all of it together? Hoping you can set us straight with the right terminology.
Yeah, sure. Well, the term cycle, I think, includes a lot of things to a lot of people. So what I'll be giving you is my definition. It's not that definition. Of course, cycles can be defined as a recurring pattern over time, say like a four-year cycle, like the presidential cycle. You can have short-term or other these types of cycles. Usually what I'm referring to is the business cycle, which is the pattern of economic expansions and contractions that the economy goes through, which are, I wouldn't say the same, but there is some sort of like certain patterns with it, either in terms of timing or in terms of primarily of how the asset classes work or correlate within that cycle. The pioneers in this type of work were, of course, Alvin Hayes and Martin Pring, and also John Murphy. But I think Martin Pring has done the definitive work on that in the past years. Now, I've done a bit of, improvement, but some of my additions to it. But at a high level, basically, in each cycle of economic expansion and contractions can lead anything to, say, for example, a recession or a depression or slowing growth. You have the three main asset classes, which are easier to bonds, commodities, and equity indices, and there is a certain relationship that these go through, six stages actually, these are very much identifiable, and they follow a certain particular pattern. Through that, you can do what it's called now casting rather than forecasting. Basically, you identify where you are with the rules-based framework, and using statistics, you can calculate what has happened in the past in terms of risk and reward profile. So basically, if say the S&P is rising and then you've got commodities rising and bonds rising as well, that's the most bullish part of the business cycle when three asset classes are rising. And through that, you can bring it to a different level, see which sectors are more prominent in that part of the cycle, and so on and so forth. So using a rules-based framework, using these three asset classes, of course, on top of that, you can also bring the dollar, which is my contribution to that particular framework, or and the Fed, you can do night casting and using a rules-based framework, identify where you are in the business cycle.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the rules-based framework and where do you think we are in this cycle right now?
I think we are at the last stages. I think we're right now we are at the last stages of this economic expansion. I mean, from what my data show right now, we are looking probably to, I wouldn't be surprised if we have some kind of a correction in the equity markets. But I wouldn't call it, I wouldn't be able to call a recession right now. I mean, I don't think, and I think I have enough data. I mean, there are several macro models I use, which none of them show. There are some weaknesses, structural weaknesses, but none of them shows anything flashing red. And but before we, you know, delve into this, go into this a bit deeper, let me give you a bigger picture of how I approach markets. I have what I call a multiple time frame, multiple factor approach. There is a very nice chart, if someone would, you know, someone can look it up on the internet, by a gentleman called Ian Notley, who has three cycles, if you will, like a long term, that inside it has a medium term, and then inside that has a short term. And shows the interaction between the interplay between short, intermediate, and long term. Now, the definitions of long, intermediate, and short term can be very personal. So my definition of this is for long term is the monthly, the intermediate is the weekly, and the short term is the daily. And that's why, you know, of course, that's the multiple time frame part of it. The multiple factor is I believe that each time frame has its own return drivers. So when I go into the monthly chart, I hardly look at technicals. I mean, for me, it's more fundamental. I look at the business cycle, as we mentioned before, which basically is the interaction, the correlation, the relationships between the asset classes, plus the quantification of economic data. If we go into the weekly chart, then I look at other factors such as the commitment of traders report, sentiment indicators. There's a large part of sentiment indicators. You can also look at seasonals and so forth. And then I go to the daily chart, which that's where my technical work comes in. Fundamentals are basically a way to answer the question, why? And or what will happen, and technicals is the tool to answer the question when. So using this framework, I structure my work. I go into the technical, so the monthly to see where we are in the cycle, which you answered what you asked about before. Then I go to the technical, so the weekly, which I'll be looking primarily the commitment of trader report and also various sentiment indicators. And then into the daily chart to look at the four factors that affect a price from a technical, from a price point of view.
Alex, if you can tell us why, if you can tell us when.
Why and when? Which market are you interested in?
I mean, all of it really, but if you can
all
just...
of it. Well, I think a goal, well, for the why right now, okay, let's pick, you know, the market that is most widely covered right now, which is gold. Uh-huh. Although I must stress that within the precious metals complex, gold is the bench warmer because all other precious metals right now are much, much stronger than gold. If anyone looks, I mean, I'm talking about, and this is, you know, this interview is conducted on the 14th of October, 2025. But if anyone looks at the charts, for example, of silver, palladium, and other metals in the precious metal complex, you'll see that all of them are stronger than gold. But gold is shinier; it catches the attention of media, of the people, so everyone focuses on it. So I'll go with that, you know, attention flow. Gold is looking a bit weak from a fundamental point of view, and I say primarily from a commitment of trader point of view and also from a sentiment point of view. I don't think long term on the monthly chart we have seen anything structural, but on the intermediate time frame, I think there are reasons to be taking a bit more of a defensive stance. Going back into the daily, the trend is definitely up. Momentum is very hot, as depicted by the MACD indicator. So I'm definitely not taking any shorts. And if I was to take a more defensive position, I would definitely wait to see some more weakness. But for someone who's looking to, say, postpone or look for a better position to go long, then I would probably look for some opportunity in the future, not right now.
So you think gold is hot, as we know. You don't think it can be sustained? And then when it comes to, like, for instance, gold, how do you long-term, short-term?
Yeah, not in the intermediate term. I don't see, basically, I see it very stretched from a commitment of trader point of view and from a sentiment point of view. All of the sentiment indicators I look at, and I think sentiment is very important because it's inversely correlated with liquidity. And this seems stretched, both from a commercial point of view, options data on it, open interest data on it. There are so much, a lot of sentiment indicators which indicate that there is too much speculation right now in gold. And now, of course, that doesn't mean that it will crash. But, if someone wants to, say, for example, take a position in an ETF and hold it for, on a long-term basis, I think it would be, as far as I'm concerned, because, this is not investment advice, I wouldn't be doing it right now. I wouldn't be rushing into it.
So you mentioned that gold is a bench warmer. Mm-hmm. I've never heard gold being described as a bench warmer. and so when you talk about being a bench warmer and you're excited about other commodities more, like, which commodities do you find yourself more excited about at this time?
Well, from the precious metal complex, everything else is hotter than gold. I'm talking purely from a price point of view. They've appreciated a lot more. I mean, for example, silver made an all-time high. From a price appreciation point of view, they have risen a lot more than gold. That I was just trying to make sure that although people have focused on gold, it's actually the slowest moving of the precious metal complex.
Interesting. So when we think about gold, you can't help but wonder about momentum. And you've spoken a lot about momentum. If you can tell us how you define momentum in the macro sense across the markets.
Yes, in the macro sense, on the weekly chart, I use sentiment indicators. And on the daily chart, I use the MACD, an indicator I created in 2015. And presented publicly in 2022 in the form of a paper, which I submitted to two associations, the National Association for Impact Investment Managers and the CMT Association, the Chartered Market Technician Association. And there were two competitions, and I won an award from both competitions. So to cut a long story short, the indicator I'm referring to, the MACD, is basically a volatility normalized MACD, MACD indicator. And this is how I look momentum through. I don't use the RSI or the stochastic. I'm not saying that people should. There's no value in there. Of course, there is. There are very valuable workhorses in the technical analyst community. But I believe that the MACD presents a better indicator because it's unbounded. So through that, I can look at it from momentum from a multiple time frame point of view. For example, on my chart, I have a heat map when I can see momentum, what happens on a color coded basis, both on the monthly, weekly, and daily chart. And it looks a bit stretched. Now, the usual mistake people make with momentum is the similar one they do with valuations. A stock can remain overbought or cheap from a valuation point of view a lot for a bigger period than most people think. So you can't be blindly selling overbought or oversold conditions, or buying oversold conditions. You have to be looking for the actual reversal of it.
So how do you apply the MACD to like the gold market, for instance?
That's a good point. Well, after having burned my fingers countless times, I do not sell tops and bottoms, try to buy bottoms. What I do is basically wait for what I call a structural break. For example, this particular example, for gold to top out, fall, and then wait for the second rally for it to resume. I found that the second and third tops are much more profitable. Sometimes even seconds are part of the topping formation or the bottom formation. But yeah. I definitely try not to try to catch a top. So the way I use it is more like an alert rather than a signal, indicating A, not to stop buying, stop looking for buying opportunities backed by fundamentals, and then wait for the market to start to prove that the overbought, the overextended, if you will, the risk conditions are actually there, have a break, a counter trend rally, and then try to catch the second or the third down leg. It takes a bit more patience. It doesn't sound as glamorous as calling tops and bottoms, but I think it's the safest choice.
So when you say safe, like what advantage does the MACD give you? And you say it's better to not go for top and bottom. Like, can you help me understand how that works?
Yeah, well, basically I wait for the MACD to go over 150. Let's talk about tops. Go over 150, which is the risk level. 150 from the MACD, basically it means momentum is 1.5 times its volatility. So once it's reached that level, then price will start forming lower highs and lower lows. And this is the signal for me to start looking for short opportunities after the formation of a lower high and lower low formation, which again can be defined on a systematic basis.
Alex, so with your systems in place, I mean, you say you're not one of the smartest thinkers, but you came up with the smart trading system and the MACD, and you won an award for that. Like, if you can help us understand when you think it's time to stop trusting the trend, what signals or alerts you mentioned, what signals do you use to confirm or fade what momentum is telling you?
All right, good question. That's a good question. Okay, let me, first of all, my decision-making framework has 12 steps. Four of them I look at the macro, as I mentioned, the monthly and the weekly chart. So if you look at like a roadmap, so four are on the monthly and weekly. Then I go into the technicals, trend, momentum, volatility, and relative strength. And then I go put these into a trading framework. This is what I call the 4S framework, which is setup, signal, size, and stop, the 4S framework. Basically, this is all strategies independent of what's the philosophy behind them. Mm-hmm. Come to these four components: a setup, a signal, your stop, and then your size. So part of the setup can be fundamentals and technicals. So once MACD or other types of data, for example, the commitment of traders report issue alerts, then I look for a signal. Now, one of the ways I frame these the strategies is on what I call a semi-systematic basis, which means I'm not fully automated. The way I think that is best for me, at least, is that there are advantages to discretionary trading, and there are advantages also to systematic trading. So I'm trying to combine best of two worlds, something that matches my character. So the setup and the size are the discretionary rules-based components. The middle ones, the signal and the stop, are fully systematic. Why is the setup semi-discretionary? Is because I look at a lot of data. I want to be keeping a feel of the market when I go from, say, neutral to long, or from neutral to short. And once I've got that, and say, okay, I have enough data to classify as a market short, then I open up my signal generating mechanisms, which is basically pattern recognition, to start giving me an entry in a position, which I have, of course, predefined as bullish or bearish based on the fundamentals first, primarily, which I then look into be show in price technicals, and then go into the signal generation mechanism. So this is how I try to combine both systematic and discretionary trading in, you know, a semi-systematic rules-based framework.
So when it comes to momentum, Alex, you know, traders aren't using your, some of them are, thank goodness, and some of them aren't, using your systems. But like, what do traders usually get wrong when it comes to momentum?
The most usual mistakes I see people make, well, actually there are four mistakes that people usually see, that which are the most common ones. Funny enough, I talked about this quite elaborately on the presentation I did for the IFTA conference, the International Federation of Technical Analysts in Frankfurt a couple of weeks ago. The first mistake I usually people see is what I call indicatoritis, which basically plotting on a chart 5 or 6 different momentum indicators, the RSI, the MACD, percent R, and so on and so forth. I think that's the most rookie mistake. And basically, you know, this is what, you know, statisticians call as multicollinearity. You get the same signal from each one. They do it for your confirmation, but basically you've got none of it. Just basically one indicator. There's a lot of correlation between them. So I think that's number one mistake. People, and that's remedied by saying, okay, I'll use just one indicator. Now, the second mistake usually thing is, I don't understand, is that all technical analysis indicators can be classified into two categories, all momentum technical analysis indicators. The one is the range-bound indicators, like the RSI, 0 to 100. And then you've got the unbound indicators, which is like, say, the MACD. Now, the range-bound indicators are usually normalized, as I mentioned, 0 to 100. The unbound are non-normalized. Now, the thing is, and this is what the second mistake that people do. They don't realize that each category behaves differently in different market conditions. So when it comes to ranging markets, the range-bound indicators are a better tool. So for a 0 to 100, it's much better. For example, when the market is ranging, it's better to use an RSI rather than MACD. The MACD actually will be giving a lot of false signals. If the market is trending, the better tool is a trend-following tool like the MACD. Of course, the problem here is, you know, when do you know when the market is ranging and when it is trending? And this is where my frustration was, which led to the invention of the MACDV, which basically what I wanted to do is take an unbound indicator. Basically, I wanted to have the best of two worlds, have the normalized scaling of the range-bound indicators, and put that on an unbound indicator. So basically, I normalized an unbound indicator like the MACD. And so I use just the MACD. So it stands in truly in the best of two worlds, right in the middle. So that's the second mistake. People are understanding. So that's how I solved the second mistake or the second problem there, or the challenge that traders face, which one to use. Use the MACDV. Because it's truly the best of two worlds. The third most usual mistake that people make when using momentum indicators is that it's not so much the tool, but it's the technique. And the technique is, well, they use it in a very limited fashion. What do I mean by that? For example, the RSI, they use it with basically two ways, either as overbought or as oversold, or for divergences, but a lot more patterns into the indicators rather than just overbought or oversold and divergences. And again, the MACDV helped me define a lot of these patterns. For example, there are seven core patterns that I use with the MACDV. For example, I can show when the market is rallying, when it is at risk, you know, the overbought and oversold, when it is retracing, when it has a deeper retracement, reversing, when it is range bound, so seven core patterns. So with these, I can define market action, and depending on how fast a market is going, I can pick and adjust my entry signals. And this is crucial, because if a market is defined as rallying, you have to have quicker entry mechanisms than a market that is retracing. Because if it is starting having a pullback, then you can wait for it to sort of give you some kind of a clue that it might be reversing back to the upside. But if it's rallying, then you don't have that. Time is not a luxury. You have to get in. If, of course, provided you believe that the rally will continue. So that's the third mistake that people do. They use them in very simplistic ways, overbought, oversold, and divergences. That's it. Hardly in kind of more advanced form of pattern recognition. And the fourth mistake that people do, I think they use technical analysis indicators out of context, without realizing that it's part of a bigger ecosystem. So either the technical ecosystem or fundamental ecosystem. Let's start with the technical ecosystem. Even someone. And I'm saying this because someone may be purely technically based, and I have no problem with that if they can produce the results they want. So the first principle, let's go back to first principles of price. You've got four core components of price: trend, momentum, volatility, and relative strength. So let's try to explain this through an analogy so people can perhaps understand where I'm coming from. Trend is direction. Imagine if you're in a car. So if you go north or south, that's bullish or bearish, that's direction. Momentum is the speed that the car is traveling. So you may have two cars going north in the same trend, but they're going in different speeds. So that's where the MACD comes in. The MACDV comes in. If, for example, one car has like a MACDV of 70, one is 30, you can see that the car with the 70 miles, if you want to put it in that, then is faster than one going with 30. So the momentum and the MACDV is basically a speedometer on your dashboard, a speedometer. And bringing back to the analogy of trying to compare the two indicators, the two types of indicators, the range band indicators go from 0 to 100. So basically, when your car goes above 100 miles, that won't show up because it's it can only go up to 100. And the unbound indicators is basically like a speedometer that doesn't have limits, but it also doesn't have an indication of the speed. So the MACDV solves that, and that's what momentum indicators do. They are basically speedometers. Then you've got volatility, which shows you how much heat you've got in the car. Again, I've designed another indicator for that, the volatility valuation index, which was inspired by a friend, John Bollinger, who once told me about a property of volatility, which was stuck with me, and I didn't manage to solve it up until like 10 or 12 years after, which he first told me. But it just stuck to my mind as something very important, which was that low volatility is where markets or market trends are born, and high volatility is where they go to die. So I thought that's really important. Although I don't fully grasp the consequences of that quote, but it stuck with me. And also, it stuck with me with such a point that I've always tried to define what's high volatility, what's low volatility. So I created an indicator called Volatility Valuation Index, which is exactly that. And you can see on the charts that it really does that. When there is high volatility, that's, you know, you see trend exhaustion, both to the upside and to the downside, because volatility is usually trend agnostic. Now, for equities, we have associated high volatility with bottoms and low volatility with tops, but with commodities, actually, it's the other way around. So you've got trend direction, momentum is your speedometer, volatility is, you know, shows the, say, the temperature, if you will, of the vehicle, and then you've got relative strength, which is basically your odometer. So you may have two cars headed in the same direction with different speeds, but one may be ahead of the other, even if it might have like a slower speed, but it has covered a bigger distance. So bringing back to the precious metals examination we talked about previously, from a relative strength point of view, silver has a much bigger relative strength, if you will, versus gold. So the trend would be, trying to apply these concepts to today, the trend would be the same for both markets, up. Then you would see the momentum. I'm just trying, using my hands to draw stuff. I'm sure a chart would be much better right now than me trying to explain it. But relative strength would be comparing which market has traveled more, if you will. And from a relative strength point of view, silver is much better. And the general principle, as a matter of principle, is all things being equal, it's better off to go with a stronger market than the weaker.
So when you say silver has a greater relative strength than gold, is it just kind of, does it follow in lines with how silver tends to follow gold? And right now there's a huge, maybe overzealousness with gold, and then silver is kind of yet to follow, but we're expecting the upswing that silver normally finds itself following gold.
Yeah, it could be in that sense. Although the way I refer to it in a broader sense is, for example, when you take two sectors, in the stock market, and you see which one has had the better performance in your allocated time frame. Of course, these things always change. You can see sometimes, for example, some stocks are very hot and, you know, they come up on top, and then the next quarter there are other stocks that are better performing, and so on and so forth. So it's usually more preferable to go with strong stuff on to the upside and avoid weaker stocks or markets, asset classes.
We talked about momentum. We can't treat all the asset classes the same way. If you can tell us a little bit more about how momentum behaves differently among asset classes, in particular, how does commodities, gold, and precious metals differ from the other markets?
In general, yes, I think that each market has its own DNA, different trend structures, different volatility structures, different momentum. For example, there are markets which are a bit more trendy than others. A good example of that would be the S&P 500. If someone uses a simple measure of trend, for example, a 200-bar moving average, and you measure how much time the S&P spends above the 200-day moving average and how much below, you'll find that it's about 75% of the time above the 200 bar moving average. So it has a definite bias to the upside. Bonds, on the other hand, have about 60 to 65%, of course, depending on, you know, where you begin your calculations. A market like natural gas is about 50%. So you can see that they have different levels of trendiness or bias, directional bias, if you will. So that means that you have to be adjusting your strategies. So, for example, top picking or shorting on the S&P 500, we know it's notoriously difficult. That's why I've stopped doing it. I mean, maybe people who are, you know, smarter than me or better can do it, but I find that since you have a bias of 75% going in one direction, I think my chances are better if I focus on that rather than try to catch tops and bottoms. But for other markets, for example, as I mentioned, natural gas or other natural resource markets, when there is no huge directional bias to the upside or to the downside, then you can focus your strategies both on the long and the short side without any kind of bias. Now, you can also look at volatility, how volatility affects its markets. Some bit more volatile than others, or they have different volatility patterns. For example, some markets top on high volatility and others bottom on high volatility. Again, these are small nuances that you have to be watching on each market and for momentum as well. And then you can look at the data and say, okay, for the market, if it is, and this is one of the studies I did on the paper. So if anyone would like to contact me, I can send them the paper and share the results. Basically, what I did is I took the three asset classes that I mentioned before, studied, you know, the trend characteristics and see how they can have trend defined over bought and oversold levels. And from a momentum point of view, the results were remarkably the same. So the markets were getting oversold on different levels if they were in a bull market than in a bear market, but the actual levels themselves within each bull or bear market were pretty much the same.
Alex, when you look at asset classes, I mean, when you look at equities, when you look at bonds, commodities, you know, is there anything that stands out to you right now? Are there any divergences or setups that you find particularly interesting at the moment?
I'm looking for opportunities in the grain market right now and also on fixed income. The two markets I would try to stay away from is equities and gold.
Tell me more.
Yeah. Well, let me open up. I think we could share a chat or something. Right. Well, the markets and primarily, let me see. Right. Yeah, the grains. Yeah, I'm looking at corn futures basically right now. Do you think I could share a chart?
Yeah.
Is it would be possible or not?
Yes, you can.
Perfect. Okay. Because I think it would be best if I showed a chart. Let me see. Try to see if I do without messing up the share screen. Ah, there you go. Perfect. Share. Can you see my screen now?
Yes.
Perfect. Right. So this is how I look from a technical point of view. This is a chart of corn futures. All right. So the top one is a chart of corn futures. Let me explain what we see. The top part is the corn futures. The second clip is commitment of trader data. Net positions. The blue line is large speculators. The red line is net commercial positions. The third clip is one of my sentiment indicators. And as I mentioned, sentiment is very important because it relates to liquidity. And the third clip is what I call the smart sentiment composite, which basically, because again, sentiment, you know, the various types of sentiment indicators, just try to gather them to a composite. It's just that I think, you know, this is the total market liquidity as I define it, I think it's very important. I just want to be seeing it on its own as well. Now, what do these arrows come from? These are generated from the commitment of trader report. So basically on commercial activities, the large arrows are major alerts. The smaller ones are minor. Usually the ones that I found more actionable are the large ones. So again, we are on the weekly chart. So what do I, how does this work? Now, for example, last week we had a major signal on the weekly chart. Whoops. On the weekly chart of corn. Is that an automatic sell? No. What I do is I go on the daily chart, go on to my technicals, and then look at the factors we mentioned before. So trend for me is defined in an 8-stage framework. I've got on YouTube a tutorial which explains this. If someone would like to call me, I can send them the link. Then I look at momentum, which is the MACDV, which I mentioned here. Mm-hmm. This is the seasonals we look at. And this is the volatility valuation. Volatility valuation, again, as I mentioned, high volatility is trend exhaustion, high volatility, trend exhaustion, high volatility, trend exhaustion. And once I have a directional bias on the weekly chart, which means, as we saw previously, the commitment of the report was a sell, then I wait for some kind of a reversal on the daily chart, which we have had this using the MACDV from the 19th of September. So what I do is basically go into my signal generating mechanism. Obviously, since I have a short bias, I'll be taking just short signal, so I will delete the buy signal alerts, and this is how the chart looks like with two short signals, one on the 19th and one on the 9th of October. So this is the last position of on corn futures. So also this is a real-time practical example of how I look at markets. Now, of course, there are a lot of nuances, but I'm just giving it a high level how this operates. Look at this on the weekly chart, the commitment of traders report, sentiment, and then go with the technicals on the daily chart, including seasonality.
Alex, this is very helpful. I do have some questions about first of all, do you ever review trades?
Yes.
Trades that didn't work out, and I guess, do you do autopsies, if you will, and are they helpful or are they counterproductive?
No, I think it's very, and I like the word you use, the autopsies, which is like that. I mean, it's a very clever way to term it. Yes, I do have a look at the trading journal. As a friend Larry Williams said, it's the most important technical analysis book you will ever read. And it's quite a smart and insightful quote, because that will truly reveal the mistakes I do and your trading journal. And I think that trading journals there are two types of trading journals. One is the truly the accounting part, where I go in, where I go out, and what is the result. And also the emotions journal, which I think is also very important to note down, what was your thinking or your assumptions. For example, I thought I would bypass this trade, blah, blah. And then you can see the biases. And that's why one of the needs for me to become rules-based, because in order to fight my own flaws and biases. For example, I had at the beginning of my career, I had the issue of going against the trend. I don't know why. I always wanted to buck the trend. I mean, the market was rising. And I always try to find some kind of a way to justify that. Oh, the market is overbought. Or the market is expensive. All this and that. And then through the results, which were not good, I found that I shouldn't be doing it, but I also wanted to go deeper to the technical aspects of it, not just the behavior. The behavior was that it had an inherent bias to be counter-trend. So that was the psychological part of me that I didn't, you know, I had to work with or work on. And then also the technical, which was, okay, the indicators were showing this. I knew, of course, I was using it as an excuse, but also had to see why the indicator was behaving like this. So I had to work both on the technical and the behavioral part, if you will. So, and this could be revealed only through a trading journal, because memory is the worst tool you can use, because there is an inherent bias to go away from pain and towards pleasure. That goes for everyone. And that means that we will be remembering more vividly the profitable trades, not so much the losing ones. So we will. There is a big chance that we may be reinforcing bad behaviors. We had a positive result out of luck, if you will. So, for example, you know, you may be trading with a trend. You may be making mistakes, but because, of course, someone was, you know, smart enough or lucky enough to be trading with the trend, a lot of the mistakes they may do, for example, position sizing in entries, in stop sizing, or may be hidden because the trend masked them up. So if you will, so imagine if you can picture the way you see this, it's like having a baby who's holding a basketball and the father is holding it up to the hoop, and the baby, you know, thinks they can, you know, puts the basket and they see, oh, I did it on my own. And during a bull market, this is what happens. You know, oh, I did this on my own. But no, if you just follow the trend. I mean, it's always good to follow the trend, but the thing is, there are other types of mistakes that one can do. And following the trend, of course, is positive, but they may mask these.
So you and I joked off the air that you're giving me credit for the autopsy terminology. I'm giving you credit for the emotional journal that I think is vital, but I've never heard of someone keeping multiple journals, one just for the emotional part of it. If you can tell me kind of your rule of thumb on, you know, like people put a lot of emphasis on trends. People put, you know, nobody likes losing money. No, everybody likes gaining money. And so what's your rule of thumb for cutting losses, cutting losers, and, you know, adding to winners? Do you have routines? Do you have tools to help you stay objective? You know, I know you got the MACD V, but like, how do you keep, you know, bias and narrative from creeping into your decision making?
That's a good point, Steve. Well, I had a big problem of following biases and narratives and news back in the day when I started out. Yeah, that was in late 1998. Now, if I was starting out today, I think I would have probably gone mental, because now you've got internet, Twitter, 1,000 news feeds. Back in the day, these things didn't exist. So that was both good and bad. It was bad because you had less access to real-time information, but it was also good because you had, you know, less access to real-time information. They had more. Now you have a lot more noise. You have an information overload. So that's created the need for me to create this rules-based framework, which I think it's actually twice as important in nowadays. Part of this framework is also stop placement, risk management. Because, yeah, of course, you can look at the commitment of trader support. For example, the trader showed you on corn. Yeah, okay, you know, commercials are doing this. Seasonality is, you know, actually this particular chart was positive. The trend is on your way, but things may not go as expected. So the only way I can keep my capital intact is if I manage to keep a cap on the amount of lose when I'm wrong, because this is the only thing I can control the market, kind of control, because of course the market can gap up. But have a sense of control is the risk management. I can't control if the trade will go my way 100%, but I kind of control where I will get out. So setting a stop, a hard stop, not a mental stop. Mental stops are the best way to make you mental. You know, placing them, also when I get, it's very difficult. You'll always find a way to say, oh, maybe this narrative will, you know, maybe if I keep it a bit longer, or maybe this or maybe that. So no, you have to put the stop placement in. There are various types of, like, within the exits, there are various types of stops. Obviously, you've got the stop loss. Again, there are many ways to define that. You've got a trailing stop, you've got a target. Again, there are various types of stocks which you have to, I think, adjust to the strategy you're following. So, for example, if you want to be taking a long-term trend following strategy, obviously you have to be taking a trailing stop. You shouldn't be using targets, because, for example, in a trend following strategy, what you're relying on the market, a small number of markets will produce a very big result, versus a large number of markets will be produce losses. So again, depending on the strategy, if you're doing mean reversion, it's very good actually to be using targets. But in all cases, you have to be limiting your stops. I think it's absolutely imperative. That and position sizing. I don't think anything can affect your results as much as your stop placement, of course, your position sizing.
Alex, if we wanted to follow your work, I mean, I've learned quite a bit from you here in the brief time that we've had, but if we wanted to follow your work on social, your website, and learn more about you, your systems, benefit from your services, and just kind of be able to pick your brain and learn from you, or go deeper and connect, how do we do so?
Well, for the people that have managed to stay awake through this presentation, and if they want to be tortured more, they can go to my website, www.alexspiroglou.com. It's alexspiroglou.com. What I'm doing right now is preparing to do a founding members launch for a trader development program I have, which basically will explain in a lot more detail. This trader developer program we'll have three things, which is a course, a community, and coaching. And I will be doing things a bit differently than I think what's, you know, the industry norm, in the sense that the course will be given for free. I won't be charging for information. So I will be giving the course for free, completely free, all of it, not parts of it. So I will not be charging for information, but I will be having lots of implementation. So if someone is interested, you can see it. I won't be. And the reason I'm doing this is because a lot of people who are a bit, fans of collecting courses but not putting it into practice. And this is the type of behavior which I'm really trying to avoid, because information without implementation, just expensive education. Expensive entertainment, sorry. So the coaching and community is the part that someone would like to put things into practice can come and join us. And it's very important to be surrounded by a community. And when I say community, people that everyone participates, not just an audience. And so this is how I'll be making this very different, if you will. Also having this rules-based framework. So both on the information part, having a rules-based framework and also giving it for free, and also the implementation part, having a big supporting community as well. So I'm doing the founding members launch. If someone is interested, feel free to send me an email. If not, you can get the course for free at the very least. Hopefully you get some good ideas. I know I will not be working with everyone, but I'm hoping that a lot of people can benefit even just for the free course.
Alex, could you provide your email one more time?
Yeah, Alex, first name at firstnamelastname.com, alexspiroglou.com.
Alex, thanks for being on my show. I enjoyed it, learned a lot, and hope to have you back. For those listening, if you enjoy the conversation, please share your thoughts and your takeaways. You'll find Alex's work at the bottom of the video, where to find him. Until next time, stay smart, stay curious, stay disciplined. Listen to good and smart voices like Alex Spiroglou of the Smart Trader Systems. Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Steve. It was a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Thanks, Alex.